I'm Andrew O'Hagan, host of a new podcast from the London Review of Books. It's about the bloodiest and most controversial event of the Falklands War, the sinking of the General Belgrano. Margaret Thatcher was accused of a war crime. The truth would only emerge in the pages of a private diary. This is the Belgrano Diary. Listen wherever you get your podcasts.
You're listening to the London Review of Books podcast. I'm Thomas Jones. My guest this week is John Lanchester, whose many books include Whoops, Why Everyone Owes Everyone and No One Can Pay on the 2008 financial crisis, How to Speak Money, and most recently the collection Reality and Other Stories, two of which appeared in the LRB. He has a piece in the current issue of the paper on unreliable numbers. It's a review of four books, Making It Count, Statistics and Statecraft in the Early People's Republic of China by Arnab Ghosh, Expected Goals, The Story of How Data Conquered Football by Rory Smith, Bad Data, How Governments, Politicians and the Rest of Us Get Misled by Numbers by Georgina Sturge, and Follow the Money, How Much Does Britain Cost by Paul Johnson. Hello, John, and thank you very much for joining me.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for having me.
So you have in previous pieces quoted Hegel's dictum that quantity changes quality. But these books describe something slightly different from that, more like quantity supplanting quality. Or, as you put it in the piece, discussions that were once about values and beliefs, about what a society wants to see when it looks at itself in the mirror, have increasingly turned to arguments about numbers, data, statistics. Someone endorsing that shift might describe it as, I don't know, as facts replacing fantasies, but it isn't quite that, is it?
Yes, I mean, I think it depends how heavily you want to lean on the word fact. It's definitely a shift in styles of argument. I mean, I've noticed across my adult lifetime that when politicians, people in public life, are trying to win arguments, they use convincing sounding numbers much more than they used to. And, you know, I've long noticed that, been interested in it, been curious about what was happening there. And the funny thing is that the use of facts is almost blurred into a post-truth thing about, I think it was under George Bush, they started talking about truthiness and sort of factiness, and you can have a quality of things that feel or sound like facts and that can end up hijacking the argument. Whereas, as I say in the piece, you know, one of the things about facts is that they are largely constructed things. They are, doesn't mean, you know, you can't, as it were, count the grains of sand, but there's a lot of labor goes into the production of what we consider measurable knowledge, what achieves the status of fact. And I guess that's what I'm interested in, that's what I was writing about.
I mean, throwing in a number to make your claim seem more plausible, Senator McCarthy did that in 1950 when he held up a piece of paper and said, I have in my hand a list of the names of, I mean, no one agrees how many it is, which partly makes your point, either 57 or 205 communists in the State Department, which is a number he plucked from the back of a ketchup bottle. You mentioned in the piece two more recent fake numbers that have been very consequential, or as you put it, decisively influential in British politics over the baleful last 13 years. First of all, the £350 million that Brexiters claimed on the side of a bus and elsewhere would be available for the NHS if the UK left the EU. So where did that number come from?
Well, the short answer to where did it came from, I think it's the gross amount of transfer, leaving out the fact that we got this famous rebate that Thatcher negotiated, but metaphorically banging her shoe on the table. And I can't even remember what Thatcher's argument for the size of Britain's rebate was. I think maybe it was something like linked to the amount that other countries were getting from the common agricultural policy. We didn't get the same amount, so therefore we deserve getting some of our money back. And the other thing that has a huge impact on it was the transfers from the EU for things like regional support funds and education, things like that, infrastructure payments. So I think the 350 was a gross number that left out the fact of the flow of money coming back the other way. And the number I used in the piece, which was the number that produced by the Institute of Fiscal Studies, which in turn was the one that the House of Parliament's Treasury Committee used in its report, was 110 million. So a mere £240 million lower. I saw Dominic Cummings talking about it in the hearings that committee had. Those hearings were broadcast live. And he had various sort of, you know, to put it mildly, not straightforward ways of justifying it. And it was very clear at the time that if you can get your number to be the thing that people are arguing about, you've won the argument. It sort of doesn't matter what that number is. I mean, it's the McCarthy thing, you know. If you're arguing about the exact number of communist infiltrators, you've captured the debate. And the thing underlying that, so I don't talk about it in the piece, but there's a thing in political science where they talk about the valence revolution, which is to do with the values that everyone agrees on. And if you can get them arguing on your ground about those things, you've already won. And since everybody thinks that waste is a bad thing and the NHS is a good thing, if you can get people arguing about exactly how much money is being, in quotes, wasted on Europe that could go to the NHS, then the argument's over, you've won. And that, in effect, is what happened around the Vote Leave thing.
I mean, you see that happening as well with arguments about immigration, that if the left is joining in arguments about immigration, then the anti-immigration right wing has already won because you're accepting this is something worth arguing about. And actually, as you say in the piece, again, there were some numbers about immigration that got the levels completely wrong because of the way they were counting them.
Yeah, the Vote Leave, lie, no other word for it, about 350 million quid for the NHS that would magically appear, was the one big statistical falsehood. And the other big one that had a big impact in British politics was our immigration numbers, which is sort of, as I sometimes say about various things in British politics, it'd be funny if I didn't live here, you know. Immigration, you know, went from being a thing that you were supposed, you know, there was this famous thing you're not allowed to talk about in the first few years of the century, which has a sort of element of absurdist comedy now because we spent the next 20 years talking about nothing else. But the absolutely bizarre thing was that the UK state did not know how many immigrants there were. The single most important number in our politics is anything everyone ever talks about, anything you ever hear about. It's the biggest source of division, friction, contention, political strife, the easiest dividing line between left and right, all of those things. And we just didn't know what the number was. And the number that was used guess is being polite, how many immigrants there were, was based on something called the International Passenger Survey, which started in 1961. It was supposed to be a measure of how many tourists were coming to the country, how long they were staying, where they were going, that sort of thing. And it remained the state's only tool for calculating levels of immigration till I think it was about 2016, 2017, you know, nearly 60 years, this number that's designed to work out how many people are coming to buy beefeater memorabilia. It's actually the state's only measure of population flows. I mean, just absolutely bizarre thing. And it was riddled with flaws, structural flaws, ways in which it just didn't do the job. It wasn't not the job it was designed for, but the job that it was being used for, which is measuring immigration. So because it only operated at Heathrow, Manchester and Gatwick. Well, this is now sometimes referred to as the Wizz Air problem, because an awful lot of the immigration that came to the UK after the accession of countries into the EU in the early years of the century, a lot of that didn't go through Heathrow, Gatwick and Manchester. It came through regional airports. You know, if someone's flying from Potsdam to Middlesbrough, Teesside Airport, I think it's called, it doesn't show up in the IFS. So you had literally millions of people being missed by the survey. And the other thing about it is because most people coming to the country aren't migrants. Most people are tourists who come and go. And so of the sample, I think the total number, I mean, it's a big survey, it was a big survey. The total number of people in any given year who it would sample was something like 800,000 at the airports. But most of those are people who are just coming and going transiently. You're picking out a needle in a haystack to try and find individual migrants in that, and especially migrants from smaller and more out-of-the-way countries, you're going to have a tiny fraction within that bigger number. And so the numbers have extraordinarily broad ranges of likelihood, you know, from if you're trying to detect people moving from, you know, Chad to the UK, the estimate might be, you know, one, or it might be, you know, 1,000, because the range of probabilities is and the inaccuracy built in the data is so broad. And there were also weird things. There's a piece from the FT. I remember the first time I saw, to my absolute amazement, this thing about the IFS, was a piece in the FT in 2016. And it pointed out these various other things, like it stopped working. I think it was at 10 in the evening. And quite a lot of flights leave after that, especially long-haul flights of Africa and Asia. And also, they were the people operating the survey were legally forbidden from approaching anyone who might be under 18. So by it's not allowed. Oh, whoops, you're at school. Sorry, we're not allowed to talk to you. By law, they couldn't go up to anyone who looked as if they might be young enough. And it's a bit like the drinking laws where, you know, they ask for your ID if you're under 25. It means you miss out an awful lot of younger looking people heading off to Africa and Asia. And guess what? Lots of those are students. So put all these things together and you have the state relying for the single most contentious number on something that just, you can't even say it wasn't fit for purpose because that wasn't its purpose. It was just a totally different thing altogether. And so the numbers were wildly off when the referendum was coming up and the kind of best guess for EU citizens in the country, they thought it would be kind of coming up to 3 million. And then they brought in the process for applying for settled status and there's 7.4 million applications. Some of those are repeat applications, but they think it's well over 5 million now. And so... Yeah, that's an astonishing thing to just not know. When you think of how the level of detail that it feels as if we're surveyed with and the amount of data that governments and other bodies have on us, it's absolutely bizarre to be, you know, basically 50% out on the single most important number.
Because even if you do have accurate numbers, I mean, for example, it seems that there are quite accurate numbers about the numbers of foreigners, for want of a better word, in Italy, which has been a fairly steady, somewhere between 5 and 6 million since 2014. And yet you have Giorgia Meloni going to Lampedusa at the weekend and saying, there's an invasion, there's this immigration crisis. And there is on Lampedusa, but that's partly because they've been stopping people going to the Italian mainland, so they all end up on this very small island. So in a sense, you know, the real numbers can be known, but it's still possible to create the appearance of a crisis that needn't exist for political purposes, even if you do have the right numbers.
Sure, but if the only accurate measure is, you know, before they've brought in there's new checks on exits here, so we do actually know. And just to go back to that thing about the data being wrong, one of the numbers that Theresa May was obsessed with when she was in the Home Office was the idea that there were many tens of thousands of students overstaying. That was based on this passenger survey thing, missing people going home. And the Home Office preferred number was 100,000. They were bringing exit checks and we knew that the number was 4,600 in total. And, you know, that you can have a whole argument that's based on something that's just not true. And that's part of what happened here. The other thing, though, you're right. It's always a topic that the right can use to foment division. But the state has more tools to deal with it, if you actually know. The census in the UK is every 10 years, and that was the point at which the state started realising in the 2011 census that there were many, many, many hundreds of thousands more migrants here than we realised. If you pick it up quicker, you can address some of the resulting issues more quickly. So when you look at the map of Britain where immigration is still, I mean, it's wildly down as a reported difficulty when you ask people what's on their mind. But if you look at the areas where it's still a very prominent issue and the areas that are still very pro-leave if the referendum were run again, a lot of them around Lincolnshire and the Wash, there's a kind of particular strip of the map, I was going to say of the UK, it's actually of England, where it's still a very contentious issue. And that was an area where there was just a gap between the official discourse about the level of people here and the just lived reality, where there were a lot of Eastern European migrants working often in agriculture and factory labour, that kind of thing. And people just knew it was true because they'd go to their GP's surgery and, you know, the thing on the wall would beep for the next person to see the doctor and the names would be Polish. And the government saying, well, we're expecting a maximum of 30 to 40,000 migrants nationally. And the registrations in the primary school, the Polish, the things on the border, Polish and Eastern European. And the state had no way of allocating the resources necessary to catch up, because you do, you know, if you have a significant surge in population in areas, you know, the needs, the demands it makes on governance change. You have to live in reality. That doesn't mean that the right can't use it as a tool in other ways, but just that specific thing that people's lives were observably changing in real time and there was no tool that reflected that to government. I think that you know, it wasn't done in order to create an opportunity for anti-immigrant discourse, but that's one of the things that happened. And you know, the migrant crisis in Europe is a different thing, and ultimately, but with maybe this thing underlying it, that it does ultimately come down to how you allocate resources.
And of course, there are two things there, because there's also the question of the resources and how many you have, that it's, as it were, it's supply as well as demand. And if there aren't enough places in primary school, you could say that's because there are too many people. But then, as you say, you have to accept the reality. This is how many people there are. So we need more teachers and more school buildings and all the rest of it. And one of the reasons though resources are not available is because of the austerity, as it was called, that was introduced by David Cameron and George Osborne in 2010. And of course, that, as you say in the piece, was also justified with another fake number.
Yeah, I mean, I have to start by saying I absolutely loathe austerity as a term. You know, it's a really sly Orwellian piece of language, because what its contemporary use in politics means reductions in state spending that disproportionately impact the poor. You know, if I'm paying less tax so I can switch from Prosecco to champagne thanks to austerity, that's fantastic. You know, that's the kind of austerity that we can all enthusiastically cheer. And so it's a very, very, as I say, manipulative Orwellian piece of language, I think, austerity, because that is what it is. It's reductions in state spending that disproportionately target the poor. And another thing I should say is that, you know, a lot of people go into politics in order to shrink the state. That's one of the core impulses behind right of centre politics, the idea that the state's too big, which is philosophically and politically coherent as a thing to think. You know, it's not my view, but it's a perfectly legitimate thing to think. And I think what happened is that people on the right, I mean, I know people who've said it, you know, that you occasionally in politics you get these inflection points where the argument can change, where the things that, you know, the sort of settled consensus up until Thatcher won in 1979 was called the Butlerian consensus, that both Labour and the Conservatives were essentially in the job of, you know, administering and managing a welfare state whose, you know, shape was broadly agreed on. And Thatcher's win in 1979 was a point at which that whole discourse shifted, that people were thinking, you know, we can't go on like this. I think we can't go on like this is often the underlying thought. Same thing happened in 1997 when it was clear that the Tories had just run out of steam, run out of ideas, run out of moral and economic credibility. And, you know, Labour came to office with this sense of a shift in direction. We can argue about how profound a shift in direction it turned out to be, but the fact is that, you know, spending on things like the NHS and also crucially Sure Start, targeting poorer children, you know, that was an inflection point. And I think that's what happened. The Tories saw that in the aftermath of the financial crash. People like Osborne and Cameron saw pretty clearly that this was an inflection point. I mean, conservative people, I know, said at the time that that's what this was. And it was a moment when this sort of consensus that had emerged on the size of the state, state spending, public spending, all of that, could be shifted. The aftermath of the financial crash was, in a way, it's the alibi. We can't go on like this. Well, actually, we could, especially since interest rates were more or less zero and there's never been a better time to borrow. We can't go on like this. We have to shrink the state. Looking around for tools to justify it, one of the things they picked up was a paper by two, I can't remember if they're both at Harvard, but these economists, Rogoff and Reinhardt, studying a data set that proved, in quotes, that once the ratio of debt to GDP, gross domestic product, once you're collect the debt you'd accumulated over the past was more than 90% the level of your gross domestic product, your economy shrank. It's correlation, not cause, you know, but that's what happens. If your debt to GDP ratio grows too high, your economy is going to begin to contract. And Osborne, you know, freely cited it and said, you know, the latest research shows, that's an example of that thing I was talking about kind of factiness and truthiness. The latest research shows that, and this is one of the justifications for, in quotes, austerity, you know, shrinking state spending. The thing about that, again, there's a kind of dark comedy to it. It was a student at Amherst, whose name I've forgotten. It was homework, you know, it was his research paper. I think the homework assignment was, you know, see if you can replicate research in some well-known paper in the field. So he starts trying to replicate the results in the Reinhoff and Rogoff paper, can't, asks them for their data, which they, pretty cool of them, they sent. I mean, I think if I was a world-famous economist and a student was asking for to rummage through my data set, I might, you know, politely fob them off. But anyway, they didn't. They sent them. And he goes through it and blame me down. He finds that they've made an error in summing the spreadsheet. I think they have 20 columns of data for various countries and they've only used 15 and they add the missing countries. So they're all A countries for some reason. They must have been on the left-hand side of the spreadsheet. They're A and B countries, sort of Australia, Austria, Belgium, Canada, Denmark. Once they add them in, it's not true anymore. The economies with 90% of debt to GDP are still growing. Which is an amazing thing, really, to find that, you know, this thing that shows X actually doesn't show. I mean, the economies did grow slightly slower, but they were still growing, which does refute the whole point. It says it's not going to grow and it grows. Well, that argument's not valid. And that's just another example of, I think, this thing about, you know, when is a fact not a fact? And the answer is, truthfully, quite a lot of the time.
Yeah, I've just looked his name up in your piece. He was called Thomas Herndon, the graduate student.
Thomas Herndon, that's right.
I mean, that question of these numbers proving more plastic than they at first seem. I mean, GDP itself is one of these measures, isn't it? Because it is quite a complicated number to calculate, and the way it's calculated is constantly being revised and refined. And I think this month that the Office for National Statistics has said actually GDP is much, much bigger than we thought it was last month. So actually it's 2% bigger than we thought, and there we are. So that's one thing about GDP that I'd ask you about. And then also how good a measure it is at all for the health of an economy, or whether it should be the main measure we use for a nation's well-being.
Well, I'd take the second part of that first. I mean, it's absolute pants GDP, really. firstly, because it's totaling the total productivity in the economy, adding up, you know, how on earth do they get the number at all? You know, if you think of all the different components to that. But there's wild estimates in it anyway. They have number estimates for the black economy and illegal activity, you know, drug dealing, prostitution, things where people don't pay their workers through the state, all that stuff. You know, those are completely plucked out of the air. In fact, the famous thing when your native Italy, the GDP took over that of the UK, il sorpasso, as it was called, the overtaking, the funniest thing about that was that it annoyed Nigel Lawson, who was Thatcher's chancellor, so much that there's a whole chapter in his memoir about the sorpasso and about how incredibly annoying it is. But a lot of that was, I think maybe even all of it was based on a way the Italians just changed the calculation of the black economy, the illegal economy. They just added in this number. And that's what made, you know, Italy overtake UK. And I was talking about this with an Italian economist who laughed and said, yeah, but the thing is that, you know, black economy in Italy is much bigger than that. You know, it's kind of, even this new made up number was kind of ludicrous understatement. That's an argument that Nigel Lawson didn't address in his book. So, and then the other thing is that a lot of the things that are economically productive, you know, are they really? I mean, divorce is famously good for GDP because both parties get expensive lawyers, they sell the houses and buy new houses and renovate the houses. They, you know, it generates quite a lot of economic activity. It doesn't do much for anything else, but it generates some of the kind of activities that GDP captures. The other things are things like your house burning down. which is really good for GDP because you have to employ builders, constructors, you know, surveyors fees, all of that. So in terms of how good a number it is, it's complete pants, but it's the best there is. You know, there isn't anything else that quite does that job of summing up what's going in an economy at scale. And Victoria, another reason why GDP is pants, there's a famous problem at the moment with Ireland, because Ireland has a low rate, very low rate by international standards, of corporation tax. So lots of huge global conglomerates book their revenue through Ireland. There are American companies like Apple and various big pharma companies as well. And so you get these completely crazy things. Like there was a quarter, I was coming out of COVID, I can't remember which quarter it was, where Ireland's economy grew by, I think, like 21% GDP in that quarter. And that's, you know, as works of fantastic fiction that coming out of them, Ireland ranked 1 to 3, it's sort of Finnegan's Wake, Book of Kells GDP numbers. You know, they're just completely useless. So much so that Eurostat, the European Union body that published statistics, started, you know, footnoting, you know, the contributions. And also the other thing is that they fluctuate even after they've been counted. So some Eurozone growth is actually just to do with these weird Irish GDP figures. So all of that is very, very problematic, but it's the best we've got, perhaps especially in this thing of GDP per capita. And that's relevant in the UK because although we're a big economy, I can't remember whether we're currently fifth or sixth biggest in the world, it's also quite a populous country. So actually in GDP per capita, the UK is relatively speaking a poor country. There's recent work, maybe it's in the FT, you know, looking at where the UK is in comparison to American states. I think if you strip out London and Southeast, the UK is roughly the same GDP per capita as Mississippi, the poorest American state. And it's GDP per capita where, when people talk about countries like Slovenia overtaking the UK by whatever it is, 2025, and Poland overtaking by 2030, that's the number. It's the GDP per head, which arguably isn't something we talk of. Certainly, I know that a lot of economists think that's not a thing we talk about enough in the UK, that the sense in which we have the self-image of, you know, a country that's rich and destined to get richer. That doesn't quite correspond with the reality of where we are by international comparisons. So anyway, on the... So that's the headline news. It's rubbish, but it's the best we've got. And then the thing that happened more recently was there was a sort of a narrative around COVID that was told not just here, but, you know, gained traction internationally, that we'd had a uniquely poor economic reaction to COVID, worst of the G7 nations. You know, the economy contracted more than it had anywhere else. I think the official, was it 1.6% contraction of the economy under COVID? And because they keep revising the number afterwards, because it's so hard to estimate GDP, the numbers keep getting refined and revised over time. And then, as you said, in fact, it was more or less as the piece was going to press, it came out actually that instead of whatever it was, 1.6% contraction, the economy had grown by 0.6%. And so far from being an outlier, the worst in the G7, we're slap bang in the middle, about the same as France, which lots of people had said was a famous economic success story with its reaction to COVID, and ahead of Germany, which again was, everyone was saying, had done much better than the UK. Although you kind of roll your eyes at, you know, GDP is always rubbish, you know, what do we expect? Actually, I think some of the kind of, declinist narratives around a country can be quite persistent. They can get stuck. And I think that actually was quite consequential, the idea that we were uniquely, I'm not defending the government's conduct over COVID, but I think we should live in reality. And the fact that, you know, broadly speaking, it was the same as every other rich country, I think that's quite a change from the way in which we were talking about and you know, perceiving what had happened. Because actually, just to repeat, you know, that's an important thing. On the numbers, it wasn't a, we weren't an outlier. We were right in the middle.
Have the other G7 countries also revised the way they measure their GDP yet? I mean, is it possible that they're, next month they're all going to go through their tables again and actually the UK will then slip to the bottom of that league table again?
I don't think so. I think there's an odd pattern here, which is that in the G7 countries, our GDP numbers are always the most pessimistic. There's a persistent pattern of the UK underestimating its own GDP. You know, it's quite funny in terms of national stereotypes. The country that most consistently overestimates is the United States. But I think I've forgotten the number. It's something like, I think, 0.2 each direction. The amount that they overestimate and the amount that we underestimate is about the same, but just in opposite directions. So it's possible that the numbers could change, but it's very, very, very in historic character for it to be that way round. I think it's unlikely to shift that much. I mean, as I said, there is this thing about EU numbers in general and Eurostat having this odd impact from the, you know, the really odd Irish GDP figures.
So Britain's in such a bad state as previously thought, but still not, could be better, shall we say. And you have this brilliant line in the piece that one way of explaining how Britain got to this place is to say that we waited all this time for the worst prime minister in history and then four came along all at once. But I don't, which made me laugh a lot, but I also wondered if it shouldn't be five. I mean, is Cameron not on the list as well?
I was leaving that up to the reader's choice, actually. Whether you, I mean, I fold Cameron in there because of his sort of posh boy overconfidence around the referendum. I think the referendum was such a catastrophic, idiotic, systematically divisive. You really have to think you're God's gift to do something as stupid and reckless as that. Given that, you know, a thing I've written about before, but, you know, in the 90s, the UK Independence Party, their basically their only thing on their platform was to have a referendum. And they ran in every constituency in the country and lost their deposit in every single seat. And for that idea to have been mainstreamed by these posh idiots who thought it was a clever trick, purely to manage internal politics inside the Conservative Party. I mean, all of this is just purely to manage factional divisions in the Tories. Yeah, so he's out there with me. Whereas I file Sunak under, he's much more of a, you know, he's a proper Thatcherite, Sunak. He's really is that, he's that person who shrink the state. You know, if you're poor, you just need to get up a bit earlier in the morning, all of that kind of stuff, which is completely out of kilter with where the country is and what the country needs. So he's deeply wrong about everything. But he doesn't have that a sort of appetite for chaos that the others all, you know, one way or another. I mean, May didn't have an appetite for chaos, but the combination of hostile environment and the, yeah, again, the flaw of all those people was, you know, their main focus was on managing internal divisions inside the Conservative Party instead of doing what was best for the country. So, yeah, you know, it's a pick and mix. Or you can have five.
Have five. Yeah. I know we've been told not to talk too much about football because people have other ways of getting their football news. But we're going to talk a little bit about football because, well, when the book's review is about football, then it is quite interesting to me. And that, I mean, you manage impressively not to quote the line that Mark Twain attributed to Disraeli about lies, damn lies and statistics. But it's important to acknowledge that statistics can tell us things about the world, true things that are not discoverable in other ways. And one quite clear example of this is, you mentioned two football clubs, relative newcomers to the Premier League, whose owners are massively rich professional gamblers. Because if you play the odds, and groupies do that, you have to understand how odds work, then you win. It's why those two clubs are doing well. It's why the insurance industry exists. It's why high street bookmakers do better than the punters.
And it's why there's something uniquely stupid about Donald Trump, who managed to go broke in the casino business. The thing that's really interesting about, well, there's lots of things I think that are interesting in the story about data in football. And one of them is that the opportunity, the thing that professional gamblers really like about football and the opportunity they saw in it was because there's so much emotion in it. And anything with that amount of emotion attached means that people are making mistakes. I was really struck by that as an idea, that that's where, that's the thing that has made professional gamblers' eyes light up. The fact that people felt so much and cared so deeply meant that they were screwing up. And I noticed, I'm not a professional gambler, as you might have noticed, but I often bet on World Cups, partly because it's a form of vanity, because I used to write about football, and it's a way of feeling I keep my eye in and have an edge, because I tend to watch the whole World Cup, even though every time I promise I'm not going to. And then when I've seen a bit of it, I'm not talking about betting the mortgage, but just a few quid. And I like coming out ahead because it means I'm still seeing things, as it were, still seeing things for myself and being able to make judgments accordingly. But one of the things that works with that is if you use an English betting app, England are consistently mispriced. And France are consistently underpriced. For two World Cups in a row, I made all my money in matches betting on the French to do better than the median English punter thought they would. And in fact, I've been sacked. They closed my account.
Because you're insufficiently patriotic.
Yeah, no, because if you're winning, that you're not making the money. So two football World Cups and one rugby World Cup, made money on all of them. The last time I tried to log in to bet on this rugby World Cup, the account had been closed without them even telling me. Thanks a lot, William Hill.
Which is, again, how they win. If you're winning, you big winners get chucked out of casinos.
Yeah, exactly. And even, very, very, very small winners, yeah, like me. But yeah, that's really interesting that's where the angle is, that people get so worked up about it that they aren't seeing straight. And what they do is they collect colossal amounts of data. Or in fact, actually, in the first instance, the other companies buy the data and then they buy the data off them. Other companies collect the data. And the thing that's very striking in Rory Smith's book is that it opens in the Philippines with a guy just watching a premiership match and logging every moment. And it goes up to, at the sort of highest level of data, it's 575 data points per second is the maximum they've been known to log, and up to 3 million for a match. They log the data, and then that's what they sell back to the clubs. And then the clubs employ their own analytics, and in some cases, there was a company I think called StatDNA, and they used people logging data in Laos, in the People's Republic of Laos, and then that company ended up being bought by Arsenal. And then the edge that they give to the data is how they analyze it, which is the secret sauce, really. And that's the thing that is sort of universally generalizable and applicable from football, is there's two different things. There's what you count, and then there's how you analyze it and the sense you make of it. And the secret sauce of Brighton and Brentford and Liverpool, when they started, because they were one of the first clubs to apply it at scale and very successfully, the secret sauce is not so much the numbers, it's what you can see in them that other people can't see. And there's an interesting one actually at the beginning of that book, Expected Goals, that the company, when they're training people to analyze the data, the game they give them is the Brazil-Germany match from the World Cup in, was it?
The 7-1 semi-final.
7-1, yeah. Which I've seen said is that statistically the least likely score, the most surprising score in any World Cup, Brazil at home losing 7-1. And they give them that match. And one of the things that's interesting about it is that Brazil are ahead in lots of metrics, like time in possession, pass completion rate, things like that. But the number, apart obviously from the scoreline, the number where the Germans are miles ahead is a quite esoteric thing. It's the number of players bypassed by a pass. So when the Germans pass, they'd often cut out four or five Brazilians with a single pass. And that's the reason that they completely hammered them. But as I say, I think since we've been warned off talking too much about football, I think the thing that the kind of lesson you learn from it is this thing about data and analytics, and the fact that the greater of the two actually is analytics. The sense that is made of the numbers is the thing that matters. And sometimes professionally, people become obsessed with just how much you can count instead.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f***? So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
I mean, that ability to interpret the numbers, to analyse the numbers, to understand them, I mean, there are obviously statistical methods for doing that, but I mean, there are other forms of failing to understand numbers, which are, I mean, think about, you know, we talked a bit about the COVID pandemic and the apparent failure to understand the idea of exponential growth, that if a small number is doubling every 2 days, then it's going to get very, very big very quickly. And the apparent failure to grasp that, I mean, I think this is something that Dominic Cummings talked about afterwards, that someone drawing on a whiteboard, look, here's the graph of exponential growth shooting up, and that people hadn't been aware of that. I mean, there is this innumeracy at the highest levels of decision making in March 2020. Well, I'd always say definitely led to thousands of deaths from COVID that could have been avoided. People are very like throwing numbers around to make a point, but at the same time have this sort of terrifying level of innumeracy.
I think that's right. I mean, I think it's difficult to override our instinctive feeling that we sort of understand numbers. The numbers that we understand are ones that have a human scale. You know, there's all that stuff about evolutionary groups, about 150, and lots of organisations sort of devolving around. You end up with structures ending up around that because we're sort of hardwired to get that. And very big and very small numbers we don't understand very well. And the thing about exponential growth is it's very unintuitive. The idea that, well, one person's sick, oh, okay, two people are sick. And the idea that that is everyone getting sick, actually, in a matter of days, is something that you need experts in the room to get that point across. That was a thing that, I mean, we weren't the only country to fail on that, but that is a thing, it was a clear failure. Maybe it doesn't help if you have a sort of institutional bias against certain kinds of expertise, don't have enough adults in the room, don't have enough people with scientific training in the room. I mean, it's the counterfactual. It'd be interesting to see what would have happened if Thatcher had been Prime Minister, since she was the, I think I'm right in saying she's still the only Prime Minister we've had that had a science degree. But yeah, that thing about, you know, as well, common sense will prevail under all circumstances and in all weathers, that's not always true. It's definitely not true in a pandemic.
The other, I mean, just think about other numbers which are measured obsessively and which perhaps ought to dictate policy more than they do. I mean, there's the, you know, the measure of the atmospheric concentration of carbon dioxide, which is a real fact and still going up steadily and frighteningly, and ought to be probably the most important number in any government's policy making ever, but it isn't.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know what to say about that. Other than that, that's right, it is. I think people feel impotent about it, you know, than their individual ability to. I think maybe it feeds into a different thing, you know, that as we're individual agency, it's another thing we deeply want to feel we have, you know, the ability to act on our circumstances. And our politics are quite individualistic. They're about, you know, what you want, what I want, what we need, what we deserve. And the idea of a problem that can only be solved by mass action at collective scale, and maybe it's a failure really to do with that, you know, that you have to have an imaginative leap to huge collective action on problem solving before you can begin to get your head around that number. Otherwise, it's just another number you can do nothing about and feel impotent about it.
Yeah, so I suppose in some ways it shows, yeah, it's quite a good example of how numbers can only take you so far. I mean, as you say in the piece, we have done enough counting to know what needs to be done, and that is, in a way...
Yeah, I mean, but it is an example of a thing where the headline, you know, despite people trying to persuade us to the contrary, the headline news about the science is pretty settled. You know, there's no arguing about what the physics of it is quite simple, the greenhouse effect. You know, it's what to do, not the numbers, that is the thing we should be talking about.
And what about when we have numbers which are moving in the direction we'd like them to? Well, how do we react when that happens?
We seem very good at blocking them out if they contradict narratives that we already have in our heads. An example in the UK is there's two main data sets for crime. There's a very old data set, goes back to the 1850s, and it's the police counting every crime that happens. And it's pretty much rubbish because it's very prone to you know, things being filed under different categories, it's very prone to distorted incentives. If the police are, you know, focusing on one thing and not another thing, then, you know, they're given targets, so they manipulate the data to hit the targets. If they're complaining about being under-resourced, they can make the number of crimes go up, you know, things like that. Then there's another thing, which is called the British Crime Survey, where people are surveyed at random and you're just asked, have you experienced crime in the last year? And if so, what was it and what were the consequences? And oddly enough, this is an example of a thing where picking a selection is much more accurate because you get this consistent selection and you can see trends across time much more clearly. And the odd thing about that is crime is really down a lot. The highest year for recorded crime was 1995, the tail end of the Tory government before New Labour. And it's been falling pretty steadily ever since. And in fact, in the like-for-like comparison with 1995, crime is down 80%. The numbers are distorted a bit because that the 1995 number doesn't include computer crime. But even with computer crime in, it's fallen by more than 60%. And what's striking about that is nobody feels that. Nobody feels that's true. That's just a thing that leaves no subjective mark, the sense that Britain is a much safer, more law-abiding society than it was. And I think that's... So you have to wonder why, in a way. And I think it's because it's a kind of good news story. It's structural and systematic, whereas stories of individual crime always have characters, and they often feature, almost by definition, they feature bad news. And that just breaks through much more vividly. A number gradually getting better over time just makes a much less vivid impact than something horrible happening to some individual person. Because it's a weird thing that we just never talk about that. There's really a lot less crime than there was, 20 odd years ago. So I think what the moral of that really is that stories trump numbers by and large.
So sometimes we ought to trust the numbers more than we do.
Yeah, but I think the way you can do that is by, you know, that's why this impulse to factification, truthiness, the numbers are so much more effective if you can turn them into a story. If you haven't got a story that the numbers are telling you, it's almost impossible to get people to pay attention. It's almost impossible to feel that it's what you're talking about is real.
John Lanchester, thank you very much.
Thanks, Tom.
You can read John's piece in the latest issue of the LRB, along with William Davis on Wendy Brown's Nihilistic Times, Claire Wills on Shirley Hazzard, and Dinah Birch on the history of poisoned pen letters. Subscribers to the paper can read all that and more from the current issue and from the archive of everything the LRB has ever published since 1979, including more than 120 pieces by John Lanchester. To subscribe, if you don't already, go to lrb.me/subscribe or click in the link in the podcast description. The LRB podcast is produced by Anthony Wilkes and Zoe Kilbourn. The music is by Kieran Brunt. I'm Thomas Jones. Thank you for listening.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.